Hello, and thank you for listening to Rangers to the Core. This podcast is brought to you by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Wilmington District Environmental Education Team. With this podcast, we strive to keep you informed, educated, and give you a behind-the-scenes look at everyday life as a park ranger. I'm your host, Dylan Brown, and it is time to get to the core of today's topic. Hello, I'm your host, Dylan Brown, and welcome to another episode of Rangers to the Core. And as always, today we're going to start off with our icebreaker, which is, what is your favorite lake memory? And I have to say my favorite was probably actually at Philpott, and it was when I was a real little kid. Well, I shouldn't say real little. I think about 8 years old. A family friend invited us up. They have a place still to this day on Philpott, and they invited us to camp on their land and my grandpa. So we all came up. I had no idea what to expect. I'd never seen a lake before. And we come up, we set up camp. Next morning we get up and they say, we're going to get on the boat. And this is something totally new to me. Well, I get down to the boat ramp at Goose Point, and my grandpa's friend, who's an older fella, but just full of energy, is doing something I would have never expected someone of his age to do. I get down there and he has this awesome ski boat with big speakers on it and he's blasting Kid Rock. And he's beckoning us on the boat. So we jump on and he shows us the inner tubes and stuff and how to ride them and gets us life jackets. And we're going across the lake blasting music. And as a kid, for my first time on the lake, I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. So that's probably my favorite lake memory. What about you, Grace?
That's a pretty good memory. So for mine, it goes back to my high school and college days. I grew up in West Virginia, but right on the border of Maryland. And just a few, I guess about 15 minutes from my house, was Rocky Gap State Park, and that was in Maryland. So I would spend many days in high school and college hiking the lakeside trail around the lake and would get, you know, have some pretty like meditation moments hiking along the trail of that lake, and then also getting into the lake and cooling off or whatever. So that was one of my favorite memories of spending time at a lake, and that probably, not even knowing it, maybe even set the foundation for me going into this career years later. So
that's awesome. All right, what about Carmen?
Yeah, my favorite lake memory was actually going to the lake at Camp Okanichi at Lake Lore. And I think I went to Camp Okanichi for probably 7 or 8 years. I know I started when I was pretty young, like going into third grade. And I would go every year. Some years as I got older, I would go every, you know, for 2 weeks or so. But there was a lake there. And a place we would go swimming at the lake, and then also canoeing. And one of the, I'm not going to say it was a sad part, but at the end of camp, we would have like a closing ceremony and we would, you know, sing good old camp songs and things like that. And we would, that would be our like last night there by the camp, by the lake. And we would put like a little candle on a piece of tree bark, you know, it would like melt there and then light it, and then you would float it into the water. And so it was like the closing ceremony, and that was always very, very special to me. You know, met some good friends there and always had a great time at summer camp. So that was one of my favorite lake memories.
Oh yeah, that's a good one. I grew up going to Camp Raven Knob, and we had a little lake on Camp Raven Knob, and they incorporated the lake into our Order of the Arrow ceremony every week of summer camp, which was always really neat to watch. For those that don't know, Order of the Arrow is a kind of like a honor group inside of Scouts of America now. But anyways, yeah, Carmen, I definitely feel you on that with the lake at camp. There's something about lake at camp when you're with your friends and away from your parents. It just makes it a lot more fun.
Yes.
All right, what about you, Elaine?
Yeah, my favorite lake memory growing up was I would go with my family to Pinecrest Lake, which was up in the mountains in California. My grandparents had a cabin up there, so we would stay for about a week. And every day we would go and we would hike around the lake. And then afterwards, we would go and get ice cream and go to the beach and spend the afternoon on the beach going swimming. That's where I learned how to canoe and paddleboard and a little bit of sailing. So it was a great time spending all day, every day for a week at the lake, in the water, making those memories with my family.
That lake's sort of like an alpine lake type deal. Like, was it high up in the mountains?
Yeah, it was. So it was a lot of getting used to watching the weather. We would get afternoon thunderstorms a lot, which would last for maybe a couple hours, and then we could go back out on the water. But yeah, it was surrounded by mountains. So a lot of great hiking opportunities out there.
Man, I love those high elevation lakes out west. There's just something about like feeling like you're in a bowl of water surrounded by mountains. It's awesome. All right. What about David Schwartz?
And you guys are giving all like emotional heart to heart stories and everything. I don't know if my memory is that great in terms of a story, but the first thing that popped into my head was when I was a temporary at Car Lake, just living on the lake. I had a canoe, not a canoe, a kayak that in the off days I would just take and launch from my lake house. And just kind of enjoy going fishing, just relaxing on the water, blasting Kid Rock. I think that's what you do at Coral Lakes, blasting Kid Rock and everything. So, no, I really didn't blast Kid Rock, but I think I need to. So just kayaking is definitely awesome. You can either, you know, do a lot of things out there. So it was a pretty good memory for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I just got a kayak last year, and I have really been enjoying it, and been taking my 7-year-old with me some. We've been having a blast on that thing.
Yeah, with a boat, you need like a trailer and insurance and all of that. But the kayak is just you in the water pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. All right. What about Rose? And Rose, we will introduce you formally in a little while, but what is your favorite lake memory?
Okay, well, I'm glad you guys started talking about camps, because I had not thought about this in some time, because as you know, David and I are probably a couple decades older than most of you folks. As a 9-year-old growing up in Western New York, outside of Buffalo, there is a camp called Cradle Beach Camp that I went to, and it's right on Lake Erie. And, you know, we did the usual, the canoeing, the swimming, but it was interesting in that they had multiple cabins, and it was a kind of a multi-race, multi-age camp, and, you know, boys and girls. And so like the cabins were named after Native American tribes. So there was like Onondaga and Huron and Cherokee and Shawnee and some other ones. And so we would during meal times up at the big house, you know, every cabin would sit at their table with their cabin mates, and we would have like these little competitions between the tables, and, you know, we'd like who could sing the loudest or pound on the table the loudest. And so that was always fun. And you know, down on the beach at the lake, I remember a lot of the evening activities. We would dig holes in the sand and pour in wax and make candles, you know, with the sand kind of as the base. And that's one of my neat craft making memories from camp. But basically it was a really good experience for me at that time, because I hadn't been exposed to other races really growing up in the suburb of Buffalo. And also there were kids who had who were handicapped in a multitude of ways, you know, kids who had lost their vision, kids with, you know, might be missing a limb. So it was kind of a big mix of all, you know, different aspects of people in society, and it had a big impact on, you know, teaching me tolerance and acceptance and things. So that's, you know, that's Cradle Beach had a really big influence on me growing up.
Now that's spoken by someone with some years and years of wisdom right there. I like that. Thank you, Rose. That was great.
Sure.
A lot to unravel there. I mean, you hit on so many things. That's awesome. We'll let that speak for itself. All right. Now we're going to move on to Mr. David Crowder.
Well, I grew up right here on Bugs Island Lake, or Kerr Lake, as it's known by a lot of people. And I would think just using the lake in general. As teenagers, we learned to water ski. I had a couple friends that had boats, and that learning to ski and skiing every weekend and having a good time, it was just a lot of fun. And I wish I could go back and do it again, but I don't think I could. But that and fishing on the lake, had a lot of memories with my grandparents on the lake. It was just a great place to grow up and great place to live.
That's awesome, David. Yeah, I've always been envious of people who have got to grow up close to a lake or had easy access. Like, we got a couple of employees here that one of them literally grew up on a road or across the road from one of our real popular boat launches. And I thought, man, the things I would have got into as a kid if I lived that close to the lake. So that's great. My mama probably would always been yelling for me to come in from fishing. It's probably what it would have been. All right. So without further ado, let's move on to Carmen. And she is going to share with us the core of today's podcast and introduce our guest. So, Carmen, I'll let you take it.
All right. Today, we are going to dive into the shoreline program at our lake projects. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers policy is to provide for the management of public land and water associated with Wilmington District lake projects in a manner that promotes the safe and healthful public use of the shoreline while assuring conservation of natural resources for present and future generations. To provide the public with a guide to how we oversee this process, each lake project that has a shoreline program has established a shoreline management plan. The intent of the shoreline management plan is to achieve a balance between permitted private uses and long-term resource protection, including ensuring that public access is preserved. Lake projects issue permits for many shoreline uses, including docks, underbrushing, grass mowing, shoreline protection, steps, walkways, etc., in limited development zoned areas. Today, we have two special guests with us, Rose Rayleigh and David Crowder, both of whom work at John H. Carr Dam and Reservoir as shoreline rangers.
Awesome. Thank you, Carmen. I'd like to formally now introduce our guest, and we'll start with Miss Rose Rayleigh. And Rose, if you don't mind, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, a quick snippet of your career and where you are today with it?
Well, I'll try to make it quick. So I've had kind of a wandering career. I've put about 20 years into federal service at this point. And, you know, I went to school for wildlife biology. I graduated from SUNY ESF in Syracuse and immediately, you know, tried to get lots of jobs doing wildlife work. And most of those jobs ended up being 3-month stints here and there. So I did some work. I've worked with Fish and Wildlife. I've worked with the Park Service. I've worked with National Marine Fisheries. I did some things out west, out of Seattle, went on commercial fishing boats up in Alaska. And then my more long-term jobs have been on the East Coast, working with Fish and Wildlife at Iroquois Wildlife Refuge in New York State, and then at Assateague Island National Seashore for the Park Service. All of these jobs, mostly doing biology work with fish, wildlife, or plants. My most recent job before I came here was at Roanoke River Wildlife Refuge, where I was there for over a decade as a biotech. And I guess I decided it was time to get out of the swamp and not have to wear chest waders in the hot, humid North Carolina summers. And I, made the switch to the shoreline job here.
That's awesome. So how long have you been at John Carr Reservoir?
Just 3 years now.
Awesome. Sounds great. So you came on about the same time I came on at Philpot then, because I think this is going on my fourth season this year.
Okay.
That's awesome. All right. So, Mr. David Crowder, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, when I first started working here, I was just a teenager, and the maintenance for the lake was in-house. It was not contracted, and I had a summer job working with the maintenance crew, and I got to work out of the marine shop. And that was a lot of fun, a lot of putting out buoys when they'd break loose. And we actually had the old tugboat Dan on the water at that time. And we had a barge with a big crane on it, and we would push that all over the lake and clean up some of the driftwood out of the coves with it. So that's where I got started here. Then after I went to college, I was a teacher. And a lot of the teachers had summer jobs down here as rec rangers or seasonal rangers. And I did that for 2 years in the 80s. And after I retired from teaching, I reapplied and got hired back as a seasonal ranger. And 3 years ago, I applied for the shoreline job and got that. And so I've been full-time here going into my third year.
That's awesome, David. So why don't you guys, and you guys can either alternate or pick one or to answer the question, however you guys want to do it. We try to keep it a little conversation-like if we can, and everybody else feel free to pitch in wherever you want. But so our first question about the shoreline programs is, what exactly do you do as a shoreline ranger?
Well, we essentially assist property owners that have property adjacent to core land in obtaining shoreline permits, or if they're already there, renewing their existing permits. And that also includes inspecting docks and walkways and meeting with people and, you know, answering tons and tons of questions and, you know, basically telling them the rules and regs of the Corps so that, you know, everybody can get along and not have issues and enjoy, you know, enjoy the natural resource as well as being able to recreate.
Okay. So how many permits are you guys responsible for?
So we have approximately 4,000 permits here. We have four shoreline rangers. We each are assigned to an area. And so essentially each ranger has about 1,000 permits. And, you know, those permits are renewed every 5 years. So it's a lot. We, I guess, manage as best we can, even though sometimes we feel like, you know, it's more than we can handle sometimes.
I'm sure. And that's a lot of time on the water, too. Like it, for folks out there that want a park ranger job where you tend to spend a lot of times on the boat, which granted, there's a lot of admin time on the back end. We might talk about that a little bit later. But going out and doing those shoreline inspections, that's definitely a way to get some boat time in.
Yeah, I wish we had more boats, and I wish it was more boat time than we do get. Oftentimes we end up actually driving probably more than we're actually on the water. We drive to the, you know, to the lake sites.
Yeah, when I was doing shoreline inspections for a little bit, when it was cold, I would like to go from land. But after being chased back to my truck by a couple of dogs, I thought, you know what? I'll just face the cold on the boat.
It's definitely more, you know, more efficient way to get the work done. That's for sure.
What I find when you drive to the sites, you see a lot of people that have a lot of questions, and it really slows you down as far as getting your inspections done. But you get to meet more people, and if they have questions, you try to answer them. But it does slow you down from getting around to all of your inspection sites.
For sure. So, and like, going off of that a little bit there, David, I'm glad you brought that up. Part of the shoreline program is a lot of dealing with people. So tell us a little bit about what a shoreline management plan is and how we translate that to the people that have to abide by that in a way that we get compliance and that provides understanding for the why behind the existence of the shoreline management plan.
We have a plan that, and we have it in a booklet form, and we can give it to some of the new owners to let them understand and get a better understanding of what they can and cannot do. And then they can call us if they still have questions. And plus, it's available online at the website also of the John H. Carr website. It's just a plan. Our latest one was 2016, and it just lays out for them exactly, basically, what they can and cannot do. We all have new questions that come up, and we have to put our heads together and determine the best answer for them. It's a good manual to have. I learn, and I hear different questions every time we go out. It's something different.
Yeah, it's funny. It's almost like, or at least my experience with it, it's a lot like our regulations books go. Not so much written as much legalistically, but in the sense that everyone can kind of interpret something a little bit differently. It's a lot of both interpreting to them how it's meant to be implied versus maybe sometimes how they would wish to imply it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a guideline. It's a working guideline, I'd say, and it doesn't have all of the answers in there. So, you know, that's where the shoreline ranger comes in to, like you said, interpret the rules and the information in general. It's not all just rules and regs. It's, you know, there's a lot of good information, and it really keeps us, if I dare say, honest, because, you know, this is what's written. So this is what we should be explaining to them. And I don't know, it allows us, it really guides the shoreline ranger a lot too. You know, there's a lot of details in there, and unless we were really geniuses, which most of us are not, we're not going to remember everything, and it takes a while to learn it. So it's a very handy tool.
For sure. And also, I heard you mention the gear yours was updated. I think ours at Philpott, I think, was updated sometime in the late 80s. It's really due for a refresh. But that tells me that every lake's shoreline management plan must be different.
Yes. So as you're probably aware, not every lake even has a shoreline management plan. Apparently, I've been told that what is in a shoreline plan or whether they have one is kind of dependent on the date. And apparently after the 1970s, the Corps started managing resources differently. So, but we, you know, in our district, we have five reservoirs: Jordan Falls, John H. Carr, Philpott, and W. Carscott. Only three of those have shoreline management plans, I think, as was mentioned earlier: John H. Carr, Philpott, and W. Carscott. But yeah, if projects that don't have private shoreline uses would not be required to have a shoreline management plan.
Awesome. Thank you for that. So within that plan, I know there are different zones around the lake. Can you kind of break down for everyone what those different zones are?
Bugs Island here, we have four zones. We have the black zone, which is the right around the dam, and they're just off limits totally, not supposed to be inside the black zones. The red zones are reserved for public recreation areas like the parks and campgrounds. The yellow zones are protected areas. You can get some permits there, but docks are not allowed in the yellow zones. And then the green zones, you have limited developmental zones where they can put docks and have some permits if they meet the criteria for getting one. And then even now, we still have in some of those areas, you may find a dock that they're not allowed now because they were there before the rules actually changed and they are grandfathered to that location. So they get to maintain the dock at that spot.
Awesome. So that's really helpful. Also, while we're on the subject of the way things are labeled around the lake with all these different zones and stuff, explain for everyone what that red line is around the lake, that all that paint we see on the trees, and in some cases, a blue line even up above that one. I don't know if John Carr has one. I know Kerscott has one, but can you guys hit on that a little bit for us?
Sure. So the boundary line between private land and core land is normally, hopefully, marked with red or orange vertical lines that show that they basically say that the boundary line is in that direction that the lines are facing. So we always make sure when we go out to meet people that they know that that line on the tree is not necessarily their actual boundary line, and that, you know, they should always do their due diligence and either have a survey done if they're not, you know, if they don't already have some posts marking where that property line is, because we don't want them encroaching over that line, because then that's going to bring a whole bunch of problems. So those are witness trees. And there's also three lines and a dot or corner that show where the boundary turns. So that's, you know, basically those lines. Now, the blue lines that we use, the shoreline rangers go out with our blue paint when somebody reports a hazard tree, and we spray a kind of a vertical line across, or not vertical, diagonal line across the tree, and a little blue spot at the base of the tree saying that, yes, we agree, this is a hazard tree and you may have it removed. And so that's some of those paint lines that you would see out there.
Awesome. And Grace, you might have to jump in on this a little bit. I know at Kerscott, they have a water easement line that's marked with a light blue paint up above the red paint. What do you know about the water easement line?
So we have different shoreline allocations of how we do it. Public recreation, limited development, protected and prohibited. But I don't know if that's what you're asking.
At John H. Carr, we don't have blue lines above our red marking witness lines. But, you know,
I don't know what that means if that's on.
David's saying some of the maps show blue. I mean, you know, the 320 line is our high watermark line, but that's not put on the trees. But that is a lot of our shoreline is the boundary line is based on the 320 high watermark.
Gotcha. If I remember correctly, at Kerscott, the government fee line or the red government boundary was at 1080. And then above that, they have a water easement line that...
like the flowage easement line?
Yes, oh, yeah, exactly.
It sounds like flowage. Okay.
Yeah. Now, unless they haven't done that blue line in a long time, I know we need to paint our blue line, but I thought it was our fee... like the blue line on the trees was our fee line boundary. And then the red line is our flowage easement, but I might be getting those confused. I know we have like the orangish red line that we walk all the time. And that's what like you can, maybe that's our fee line. And then our blue line is what we can legally flood to.
I think all this is a good example of how different projects manage things differently. You know, even down to maybe how lines are painted. It all kind of depends on how, you know, maybe the topography is or the adjacent landowners are or what's being leased. But there can be a lot of variation. Even though we have very similar plans in our basic rules and regs, there can be a lot of variation amongst the how they're actually managed, you know, at that project.
Yeah, and I think Grace hit it pretty well on the head there. My memory is starting to come back about that a little bit, is that blue flowage easement line is like the maximum flood potential of the lake. So it's kind of to let property owners know that, you know, between the blue and red line, an event could happen, but the red line is what we're most concerned about.
We also have a small number of flowage easement properties here at John H. Carr, but we don't have anything marking where that high water line is. I mean, there are people who have actually landowners who have put in little posts that, you know, say this is where the water was at this date kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting how everyone sort of manages it differently, not necessarily as individuals, but as going back to the management plan in general, how they each kind of have their own little personalities a little bit based on who had their hand in drawing them up. So that's pretty neat. So going back to our red line, so what, you know, that delineates Corps of Engineers land from private land. So as a private landowner, or even as a member of the public, what can and can't I do on the government side of that red line versus the private side?
Well, you can hike, you can fish on the government side, you can picnic. You cannot camp. We have plenty of campground around the lake, both state and federal, but you can't just pitch a tent and camp on Corps property. Other than that, in relation to the dock permits, a lot of people, they always ask us, I see some people on my dock and I didn't give them permission to go there. Well, they're not supposed to be on private docks. They're privately owned. They lease the area for their permit and their dock from the Corps of Engineers. But of course they can fish from the shoreline if they want to, but they're not supposed to actually use other people's docks without their permission. You can, I don't know if I mentioned hunting, but hunting is allowed, but of course you have to go along with the state laws with the hunting. The main thing is the encroachments, and we may get into that a little more later, but you can't have property on the Corps property. If you take kayaks or canoes down to the lake, you're supposed to take them away when you leave. A lot of people don't. Have to remind them sometimes that they need to remove their property from the lake. That's about all I can think of. I bet you wrote.
And as far as that loose property below the fee line, if I understand correctly, that's so that in the case of, we say we have a flooding event, we don't have a bunch of like private property just floating around abandoned willy-nilly in the lake or getting washed downstream or something like that. Is that basically the reason for that reg being in place?
I would say that's one of the main reasons. But the other reason is we don't want the appearance of private ownership on public land. We want, when people are coming in by boat or walking that don't necessarily have private land adjacent to the Corps, that they feel welcome to use the land and not feel like they're, you know, impinging on somebody else's area, because it really is open to the public. Now, of course, the exception would be our flow adjacent lands, in which the property owners own up to the shoreline. And then sometimes even I've seen lot lines that are drawn into the water itself. But yeah, I'd say those are the two main reasons, you know, protecting the water and the shore from having a lot of stuff scattered everywhere. And as well as, what was the other thing I said? Sorry.
No, you're good. That was a great point on the appearance of being public.
That was what it was.
That was, yeah, I've never really thought about that, but that, honestly, that's a great point. So speaking of private landowners and the appearance of everything or everything below the boundary line being public land, say I win the lottery and I build my big fancy lake house that I've always wanted. And I want the $1 million house on a hill with that beautiful view. Can I cut down trees to open up that awesome view?
Cut down your trees. Yeah, you can't just cut down trees on the Corps property. We do have permits for vegetation modification, and you have about an acre of shoreline from the marker to your shoreline. Depends on the width and the depth of it to determine exactly how much you would get, but you can cut down underbrush and vegetation up to 3 inches, about the size of a soda can. But other than that, you would have to have permission from us to cut out anything larger than that.
Okay, so say there was a, I don't know, a tree that died and is hanging over my property, or say a threat to my awesome garage that I put with my million-dollar house or my swimming pool or something like that. Could I get permission to cut something like that?
Yes. If you have a dead tree or a hazard tree that's on your property, you could give us a call and we would come in and mark it, and then you can have it taken down. I would also say that any limb that extends from the core property over your property that might be creating a hazard for you, you can remove those limbs if it's going to be a danger, because it's really over your property at that point. We don't pay to have the trees removed. That would be up to the property owner to have them taken down.
And I'd like to add that, you know, people, a lot of people, not everyone, has this idea that that it should look all nice and clean, that any dead trees should be immediately removed. And so it's more of they think it should be looking like a park. And, you know, dead trees have a lot of value for wildlife. Those snags can, you know, not just our pollinating insects, but you know, lots of birds and mammals use these trees. So we really try to encourage people, unless that tree is really a hazard to your dock or your house, or, you know, right on your path that you and your family use on a regular basis, we try to keep as many dead trees in place and let them fall on their own, you know, as much as possible.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely hit on that hard our last month's podcast with Mr. Joseph Boswell about forestry and the value that leaving dead trees standing in forest zones have. So that's awesome. And so it's important that we realize that, you know, that management carries on everywhere around the lake and not just certain timber zones. So that's a great point, Rose. Thank you. Now, what about, you know, I want that pretty green lawn that looks like Augusta Golf Course. So as far as these pesky leaves and stuff from trees, you know, what all can I burn around there?
You said, what can you burn?
Yes, sir.
All right. If you, again, you can't just clean the ground up between you and the lake. That's supposed to stay as it is. You can have an improved walkway, which would allow you a nice gravel walkway down to your dock area. Now, if you have a lot of driftwood that comes up into your cove or to where your dock is, when the water level goes below 300, you can go down and clean up the shoreline and burn it below 300. You need to follow all the whatever burning laws are in effect at the time, just to make sure that you're in compliance there.
So basically, just like our campground rules for firewood, is you can collect the stuff that's dead and down.
Yes.
Awesome. All right. So I know the parameters now of my million-dollar house that I just bought with my lottery money. Big dreams here. What is the permitting process for putting my fancy dock adjacent to my land?
Okay, so the first thing, we've established that you have legal access, but I guess I'll mention, you know, legal access to the lake means you're either an adjacent property owner, or you have dedicated subdivision access, or, obviously a flowage easement, you would have access already. And we used to have, we're not doing these anymore, but we used to have deeded easements in which a property owner might have, like a brother or sister or uncle or somebody that doesn't live in the area, but they want to also have access to the lake, and if there's space, you know, even put in a dock. So if that exists, that would be called a deeded easement, and they would be able to access also. So once you have that dedicated access, then you could, if your property already, let me see how I want to say this. If you're applying for an individual permit, which means that you definitely have adjacent property access, you need to meet our spacing requirements from any existing docks. So we require that there needs to be 100 feet of space between where your dock will go and existing ones are. And there needs to be a minimum of 3 feet of water depth at where your dock would be in place in the water. And then the boundary line, I guess I should have mentioned this first, the boundary line between you and the core needs to have a width of at least 50 feet in order to get a permit. Now, for a lot of our permits, you know, the lake is really getting filled up fast with permits. So we do still have some space here and there for new permits, but a lot of our permits are existing, and we have a lot of turnover with ownership of properties. And in that case, they're basically oftentimes just reissuing the same type of permit that the previous owner had.
Okay, let me ask you this. Why my big, fancy new dock to go with my million-dollar house is being engineered? Can I have a mooring buoy in the meantime?
Yes, you can meet all the criteria, and if you want to hold that spot for your dock when you get it, you can go with a buoy permit to begin with. And that can always be modified when you decide to install your dock in that location.
All right. So this is going pretty smooth so far. Now let's talk about my dock plans. You know, I want a big, fancy dock. You know, I think, you know, with all this money I got now, I think I'm going to have me at least, you know, let's see, I need a ski boat, a pontoon, and a bass boat, and then I'm going to need a couple jet skis. So, you know, that's going to take a pretty big dock. So, and not only the dock, but all that landscaping to get from my house to the dock. You know, I want some nice rock steps and some pretty flowers and all that stuff. So how does all that work in this big permitting process?
So you've already kind of stepped on our toes with the trying to give it the appearance of personal ownership. So we're not going to let you put in your flowers and your shrubs and your, you know, other possibly invasive exotic plants. But, you know, the stone steps thing we have seen down kind of near people's docks between their, you know, where the path ends, and or even, I guess, occasionally on the path. We really discourage that kind of thing. We allow, we are always telling people when they ask about gravel in their path, we're like, if you have an improved walkway permit, you can put down number 57 gravel, which is pretty much the same gravel you would use on the driveway. And the reason we use that as opposed to crush and run or pea gravel, which most people would find more attractive or nicer to their, you know, bare feet, it washes out and it doesn't allow water to percolate into the ground. It basically washes right down to the lake. So that's one thing. As far as your big fancy dock, we do have limitations on the size of that dock. And depending on whether you go with an individual kind of T dock or a slip dock, the sizes will vary. But those sizes also will depend on your neighbor's existing docks. We have a rule that you can't be closer than 50 feet to any existing docks. So by water, 100 feet by land and 50 feet by water. So, you know, we would, as the shoreline ranger, go down with the landowner and evaluate all these things and tell them, this is what you can do, this is what you can't do. And, you know, and they have to work with that. The other requirement is a lot of our, you know, there's a lot of small coves on this lake. And so one of our main requirements is that you can't extend your gangway and your dock out more than a third of the cove width. So we try to get people to orient their docks perpendicular to the shoreline. And if that orientation takes you kind of directly across, say, a 100-foot wide cove, you're going to have a pretty small dock to not go beyond that one-third distance.
Okay. I'm taking notes here, so we're looking good so far. Now, what kind of things are allowed on the dock? Because I'm thinking, you know, a double-decker, you know, my top deck's going to be a party deck, so I'm going to have some electricity down there for my wet bar and my speakers and my sound system, and, you know, I'm going to have some lights, you know. So are all those things allowed?
You can have some of those. The upper deck on your dock is not allowed on this lake. You can have electricity, which has to be inspected and installed by a certified electrician. Has to be inspected and recertified every 5 years. The lighting that you use would have to be night sky approved. Dark sky friendly. Couldn't think of that term. And you have to be shining down. And I have Mary Rose, in case I forget a lighting. It can only be on the walkway, right? Well, only on the dock. Which is it?
So you can install electric along the walkway on posts that are above, you know, and they have to be pretty tall posts. The electric part of it needs to be above the 320 line, above the possible high flood line. And there are, you know, kind of restrictions on how close those posts can be. But we haven't seen too many of those at our lake. You know, but people do occasionally use solar lighting. Again, it's kind of discouraged to stick little solar lights along the pathway because, you know, honestly, that's something that could wash away. And it also almost falls into the creating, you know, the appearance of personal ownership. But yeah, so for the most part, the lighting should be on your dock itself. You know, if you got an electrical permit, you could put in one large tall post close to the dock with a outlet, you know, with electrical extension that needs to be able to
retract.
Thank you. So that it's above that potential high flood line. If you wanted to be able to plug in something down at the dock, but
a lot of the new docks are going to solar power for boat lifts and different things of that nature, rather than installing hardwired electric service to the dock area.
And it can be very expensive. You know, we're kind of leaning towards discouraging people, even though, you know, we still officially allow electric. If it qualifies, if it looks like it's not going to be really damaging to the environment to put in that, you know, that underground electric line, then we may permit it. But if people could, you know, get on board with the solar option, it's so much better for the environment. It's so much cheaper. And, you know, all around it may be eventually, you know, people will accept that as the better option.
All right. So I'm having a lot of fun playing devil's advocate with my new fancy lottery dock here. Okay. So my next one is I can't stand all these surfing boats that are just blowing by my dock all the time and these fishermen that are just flipping jigs and banging up against my dock, trying to fish around my dock and all this stuff. Can I put up no wake signs or no wake buoys or no fishing signs or buoys on my dock?
Red knot.
Now
it's going to be hard to keep people from using the lake. And you said, can you put up what kind of signs?
Slow wake.
Slow wake. To get a no wake buoy installed, I think is quite a process, and I don't think it even comes through us, does it?
It does not. You'd have to contact in North Carolina the Wildlife Resource Commission and in Virginia the Fish and Game, and they have a process. You have to actually do some paperwork and apply for it and have a good justification for it in order to get approved. I've been told it's not an easy process to happen. I think, you know, you might be more effective in, if possible, if it's your neighbors or their kids or someone that's, you know, causing all the disturbance, it might be more effective to work directly with your neighbors. We kind of encourage that in general, you know, when neighbors are having issues with each other, we'd prefer that they work it out, that everybody, you know, acts as adults and works things out with each other. And if, you know, and then maybe as a last resort, call your shoreline ranger, and we can try to mediate and, you know, come to a solution that's going to work for everybody.
All right. So that's quite the process. So let me think about an alternative here, okay? So I want to protect my investment, obviously. So that land around, like where my gangway attaches and all that kind of stuff, you know, from all these wakes, from all different kinds of boats and just the natural current or when a storm blows through or something like that, it's going to start washing that dirt away, I'm sure, if it's not already. So is there things I can do to protect that shoreline and that embankment to improve the longevity of my investment?
You can apply for an erosion control permit, and then we would have to go out and take a look at the area that you'd like to put the erosion control, which consists of a certain amount of landscaping, if you will, with a header and a footer, with covered by landscape cloth and installing riprap rock. I'm not sure the exact size of that, but it's pretty big. But it has to meet the criteria. First, you'd have to have at least a 3-foot drop off in the shoreline before we could actually okay it to put it down.
Yeah, as measured from the 300 MSL, mean sea level.
Okay, so how do I get permission to do that?
Yeah, you would contact us and we would come back and take a look. And if it met the criteria, then we would issue the permit for you.
We would first, after we approve it, we would have the landowner contact their own erosion control contractor to come out and give them an estimate. A lot of times, once people get those estimates, they decide maybe that erosion isn't so bad after all. but yeah, they would have to pay for it. Unfortunately, there was a time, I guess, in past years that the Corps worked out, you know, paid part of it, but that's currently not the case, unfortunately.
But he just hit the lottery. He can have it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's right. Money's no object here.
Well, that's good. Then you'll be able to put in some nice erosion control. We have a list. We have lots of lists, actually. So, you know, just we have a list of possible erosion control contractors that you could, you know, reach out to. I was just thinking about our other lists. We have a
electrician.
We have a list of electricians,
dock builders,
and you know, people are permitted to go with people not on our list, but you know, there are some kind of qualifications to that as far as dock builders go. But But yeah, it's definitely, you know, riprap is not necessarily the most attractive option, but it is an effective option that, you know, the Corps is leaning towards at this time. And we do want to try to keep that shoreline intact as much as possible.
All right. So that answers a lot of those questions, but now I'm going to flip the script, okay? I actually didn't win the lottery, but I am my great aunt's favorite nephew, and she kicked the bucket. But she had a lake house, and since I was her favorite nephew, she left it to me. So, since I inherited her lake house, what do I need to do to get her dock and everything in my name?
Well, we'd have to do possibly a change of ownership from her to you. It would be, we would need a copy of the deed of the property stating that you're the new owner. If it's left in a will, we might could go with the will. A plat of the property lines. And other than that, that's pretty much it. And a form that we have to fill out, an information form for the change of ownership. And then there would be some fees that would go along, and we would send you a bill, and we'd do the change of ownership for her permit to you.
Well, that sounds simple enough. And
it's not too bad. Occasionally you get some different variables that make it a little bit more complicated, but it's not too bad.
Good deal. And it's good that that's a decent process, because anytime, I know I kind of joked about it playing devil's advocate, but anytime someone loses someone, you know, they've already gone through enough kind of thing. So, you know, that process is a whole nother animal in itself. So the fact that it's a fairly simple process, I think it's nice. So thank you guys for playing devil's advocate with me. I do appreciate it. You were good sports. Do you have any final things that you would like to share about shoreline management in general that we didn't get to cover or anything?
It's hard to say. It's been one of the most enjoyable things I've done. I really like getting out and meeting these people. I've met a lot of good people, and most of them try to go by the rules. You know, and they understand why we ask for this or for that. And they've been very good to work with. Now, some of them, you have a hard time catching up with everybody, and makes it a little bit more difficult. But again, it's overall, it's enjoyable job.
Yeah, I agree. My favorite part about doing this job, in addition to what David was saying, besides meeting all these very interesting people with, you know, stories of their lives and the things they're doing now, you know, I've met ministers and beekeepers and all kinds of interesting folks. But as far as, you know, I just want our shoreline customers to communicate with us, and, you know, really, it would make our lives so much easier if when people change their emails or phone numbers that they let us know that. And, you know, that way at the 5-year renewal time, we're not, you know, learning that these people moved 3 years ago kind of thing. That gets a little frustrating. But I want people to think of the Corland as a nature preserve and not a park, and that keeping it natural and wild is a benefit to everyone. And it's what I think makes a lot of people move to the lake, that it's so much more natural than some of the other lakes that have docks on them.
I would also like to add that if you're looking to purchase lake property, sometimes, you know, you might have a realtor who's just trying to make a sale, and it might make that dock seem kind of, like we mentioned earlier, like you have private ownership of all that land that goes all the way down to the dock, or, you know, things like that. It's always a good idea to double check with your local shoreline management rangers at the lakes you're looking at purchasing land, and get all the ins and outs of that process we talked earlier whatever we didn't cover in this, because a lot of times, you know, folks can be a little misleading in it in an effort to make a living. So, and also on what David said, when I did this temporarily at Kerr Scott, I filled in while we had a vacancy for a little while. My favorite thing to do was going out and meeting people and talking to people. And I love construction. My minor's in building science, so I love to be I love to walk on job sites that were in progress if it was safe to do so, and, you know, talk to both the builders and the new landowners and things like that, and talk about all their features of their house and how they're incorporating the lake with it and all this fun stuff. So I always really enjoyed that kind of stuff. All right. Well, thank you, Rose and David. You have been great guests, even though I was a pain of a client. So I definitely thank you both for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun being part of this.
Yeah, I hope we answered most of people's questions. If we didn't, they can always call us.
Yeah, we encourage you, before you go buying that property, even if somebody, you know, has told you everything you need to know, reach out to the Shoreline Ranger, and so that you're not surprised when we show up and say, no, that's not the way it is.
That happens sometimes.
Right. And the thing about us as rangers, too, is, you know, we're very personable people typically. So, you know, like many things in life, when you go to do something like that, it's all about building a relationship, you know. And if you build that relationship, now you're not building that relationship to get by with anything, but you are building it so that you can have that line of communication that, you know, you both have some understanding of what's expected from both ends.
That's right.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. We're going to move on to Miss Elaine Wittry, and she's going to tell us what's on the horizon.
Yeah. So next month we will be back with another podcast talking about dam safety and all the things involved with that, including how we monitor and inspect those dams. And it is the start of our summer recreation season as well. So this upcoming month, the month of June, is Great Outdoors Month. So get outside, come visit us at one of our lakes, and make sure you're staying safe and having a lot of fun when you are recreating on our waters.
Awesome. Thank you. I love the sounds of Great Outdoors Month. That sounds awesome. All right. Mr. David Schwartz, I think we have a message from you.
All right. So we got a water safety message right now. You know, the Corps is all about water safety. In this podcast, we've been talking about shorelines. Everyone's been envisioning a dock in their mind, whether you put a boat on your dock or just being up against it. We always recommend wearing a life jacket by the dock, whether you're going to a friend's lake house and they have a dock by the water, or you're just hiking and you're right by a dock and happen to lose your contact by the dock, and the only way you can get your contact out is with a fishing pole. So you spend about 50 minutes on someone's dock with a fishing pole. Regardless, wear your life jacket when you're by the water, and especially a dock. Anyone who drowns didn't plan to drown, so a life jacket prevents you and it stays you up in the water. So just wear your life jacket when you're boating and when you're by a dock as well.
Absolutely. And get you some throwables or something to hang on that bad boy in case you have a close call at your dock. You know, you can have something to throw out there to assist with. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Dave. Yes. Yeah. I mean, reach, throw, row, don't go. If someone's having an issue by a dock, you're not supposed to go out and try to help them. You're supposed to reach with them, throw something to them, but don't go out and try to get them.
Right on. Thank you very much, David. And now for a couple quick notes. Our I Got Caught campaign is going on right now. And so we are trying to catch adults wearing their life jackets. And if we catch you wearing your life jacket, we may or may not have a special treat for you. And that helps us out a lot and helps you out a lot. Keeps people safe. We make a big deal of that on social media and stuff because, you know, we want people being safe to also be cool. So, thank you guys for helping out with that. And then last thing I was going to hit on was we just had our first big holiday of the summer, which is Memorial Day, which kind of kicks off everybody's summer. So number one, I hope you spent Memorial Day not only out there having a great barbecue, but remembering those soldiers who gave their lives for our freedom, because that's what Memorial Day is all about. So we want to thank them. And also, that kind of brought up to mind some, you know, just general holiday courtesies around the lake. You know, it's really crowded. It can be really busy. So it's always helpful if you come in the right state of mind. Don't be in a big hurry. There's probably going to be a line at the boat ramps, but also don't forget to pay those launch fees, things like that. And, keep everything going smooth. Okay. So, once again, thank you everyone for listening. If you have anything for us, feel free to reach out on any of our Facebook pages, whether it's the John H. Carr page or the Philpott page or the Kerr Scott or even our district page. Our district page, it'll get to us eventually. So thank you everyone. And as always, have a good month.